This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 1st, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Senate considers legislation that critics say could open the way to indefinite detention of American citizens. Voters in Russia get ready for a parliamentary election, but current Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's hold on power makes some weary of the democratic process. And we'll continue our look at human rights issues in Myanmar, with a focus on the Kachin people in the north of the country. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. UN Human Rights head Navi Pillay says the death toll in anti-government protests in Syria continues to grow.
We are placing the figure at 4,000, but really the reliable information coming to us is that it's much more than that. I have said that as soon as there were more and more defectors threatening to take up arms, I said this in August before the Security Council, that there's going to be a civil war. And at the moment, that's how I am characterizing this.
The international community is slowly ratcheting up pressure on the Syrian regime. Turkey has now announced sanctions against its neighbor and former ally. With the decision, it joins the European Union, U.S., and Arab League, all of whom have already severed ties with Bashar al-Assad's government. FSRN's Hermione G. reports from Istanbul.
Bashar al-Assad's government has come to the end of the road, Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said Wednesday, as he announced a package of economic sanctions against Syria. Every bullet fired, every bombed mosque, Davutoğlu said, has eliminated the legitimacy of the Syrian leadership. Cooperation between the formerly friendly governments will be suspended, and Turkey will freeze Syrian assets, along with an existing credit agreement it signed to finance infrastructure projects in the country. Turkey is also suspending all military sales and supplies. In addition, a travel ban will be imposed on members of the Syrian regime involved in the bloody crackdown. Turkey and Syria share a long border and strong economic ties, with trade between the two countries amounting to close to $2.5 billion in 2010. The Turkish foreign minister said the sanctions will remain in place until a legitimate government at peace with its people is in charge of Syria. Hermione G., FSRN, Istanbul.
Thousands of demonstrators in the rebel Republic of South Ossetia are settling in for a long, cold night. Supporters of an opposition figure who defeated her pro-Moscow rival says the fledgling republic's democracy is on the line. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more from Georgia.
Protests are moving into the fourth day after the rebel republic's highest court said it would not consider an appeal by candidate Alajioeva until next week. The former education minister took 56% of Sunday's vote, but the results were annulled a day later by the Supreme Court. She spent most of Thursday in closed-door meetings with a Russian envoy dispatched from Moscow to defuse the crisis. Earlier, she told Russian-language television that she's appealed to the Kremlin, which had supported her rival and backed the court's decision to annul the election.
We have addressed Medvedev and Putin. We are waiting for their reaction. If there is no reaction, we will have to appeal to the international community. No one will steal our victory from us.
Earlier Thursday, Gioeva delivered an ultimatum to authorities to recognize her victory or else. But that deadline has come and gone, and police have vowed not to use force against protesters unless attacked. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Tbilisi, Georgia.
Shots were fired and several people injured in the town of Timika, Indonesia today during a gathering marking the 50th anniversary of declared Papuan independence. Police have denied they used violence to disperse the crowd. Currently, the symbol of Papuan independence, the Morning Star flag, is banned in the country. Photos from Timika show crowds waving the flag in defiance of the government. Argentina has spearheaded initiatives for LGBT equality in Latin America as the first nation in the region to legalize same-sex marriage. Now the country is taking steps to advance the rights of transgendered people. For FSRN, Marie Trigona reports.
Argentina adopted a measure Wednesday that allows transgender and transsexual security personnel to be recognized under their chosen gender. Under the Security Ministry resolution, trans people can wear uniforms that correspond to their gender and may use the bathrooms of their gender identity. Federal, naval, and airport police are covered under the order. Argentina's lower house has also approved a bill that would allow transgender people to change their names and gender on all legal documents, IDs, and passports. The Senate will now have to vote and is expected to take up the legislation next year. Other gender identity laws have been passed in Latin America, but Argentina's is different because it does not require medical, psychiatric, or surgical intervention for a person to change their gender on legal documents. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
And finally, today is World AIDS Day. While treatment techniques for the virus have come a long way, access to life-saving drugs, especially in the developing world, is still limited. Today, President Obama committed an additional $50 million for AIDS patient care and drug assistance programs within the United States. He also set new goals of helping 6 million people access treatment worldwide. This is an increase of 2 million over previous targets. One NGO fighting the disease told WHYY that grants and contributions to the cause have decreased, blaming a slow economy and the growing perception that the AIDS epidemic is under control. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Senate is considering legislation that critics say will allow the indefinite detention of U.S. citizens. At the center of the debate is an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act that grants expansive powers to the federal government. FSRN's Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
All week long, the U.S. Senate has been debating the Defense Authorization Bill. It usually takes 2 weeks for lawmakers to debate and amend the bill, but this year lawmakers only have a week to change it. That has many lawmakers up in arms, especially because it contains controversial language over how the government can treat detainees. Earlier in the week, Colorado Democratic Senator Mark Udall had his amendment to examine that language more fully defeated.
Like other challenging issues we face here in the United States Senate, we should identify the problem, hold hearings, gather input from those affected by our actions, and then seek to find the most prudent solution.
Udall's amendment was defeated 37-61. The language in the bill requires the U.S. military to detain any suspected terrorist. That also includes U.S. citizens. On the Senate floor, Udall listed off administration experts who have already voiced grave concerns over the policy.
The Secretary of Defense is warning us that we may be making mistakes that will hurt our capacity to fight terrorism at home and abroad. The Director of National Intelligence is telling us that this language will create more problems than it solves. The Director of the FBI is telling Congress that these provisions will erect hurdles that make it more difficult for our law enforcement officials to collaborate in their effort to protect American citizens.
But supporters in both parties say the new detainee language is necessary for national security. Michigan Democratic Senator Carl Levin says the highest court in the land has already ruled on the matter.
There is no bar to this nation's holding one of its own citizens as an enemy combatant. Okay? That's not me. That's not Senator Graham. That's not Senator McCain. That's the Supreme Court of the United States.
And South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says the language is in keeping with international law.
Under the law of war for 200 years, you can detain enemy prisoners and question them without providing them lawyers or criminal proceedings. We're fighting a war, not a crime.
Graham says if the U.S. is under attack, even by a citizen, it wastes time to read a suspect their rights instead of questioning them for information.
Remember the Christmas Day bomber where the rights Miranda warnings were read within 45 minutes of capture? Many of us believe that when an attack on the homeland occurs, it's irresponsible to criminalize that case immediately.
But opponents say since the September 11th attacks, U.S. criminal courts have worked well for trying suspected terrorists. Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin says more than 300 such cases have been handled by criminal courts and only 6 in military tribunals.
The score, my friends, if you're paying attention, is 300-6. President Bush and President Obama used our Article III criminal courts effectively to keep America safe. And in those instances where they felt military tribunals could do it best, they turned to them with some success.
Opponents also worry that in an extreme emergency, one where the U.S. military might be deployed on the streets to calm unrest, that the detainee language could be used to abuse U.S. citizens. Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken says Congress is attempting to take a step backwards.
I fear the detention provisions in this bill forget the lessons we learned from the mistakes we made when we interned thousands of innocent Japanese, Germans, and Italians, or when we destroyed the lives of supposed communist sympathizers with nary a shred of evidence of guilt.
President Obama has threatened to veto the defense bill over the detainee language, and it doesn't seem supporters of that language have enough votes to override a veto. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Today, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi in Yangon. Human rights groups hope Clinton's talks with leaders from the military-backed civilian government of Myanmar, also known as Burma, will lead to an end of rights abuses against the country's ethnic communities and free political prisoners. This week, FSRN is taking a close look at human rights in the country. Yesterday, we explored the situation for the Rohingya people, a persecuted Muslim group in western Myanmar. Today, we focus on the Kachin people in the north. As Ron Corbin reports, recent accounts of ongoing attacks have come out, even as President Thein Sein talks of political reform in his country.
The last trip to Myanmar by a U.S. Secretary of State was more than 50 years ago. Rights groups, including the U.S.-based Campaign for Burma, are using Hillary Clinton's trip to press for further political reforms in the long military-controlled nation. The group acknowledged recent reforms but warned they could be easily reversed at any time. On Thursday, Hillary Clinton held talks with senior Myanmar government leaders, including reformist President Thein Sein and pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Thein Sein's government has released several hundred political prisoners, but rights groups hope Clinton has pressed for the release of all 1,200 remaining prisoners of conscience, as well as dialogue with the democratic opposition and representatives of ethnic minorities. Carl Thayer, a political scientist at Australia's University of New South Wales, says the visit comes soon after the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, backed Myanmar to chair the group's meetings in 2014.
It's a positive step, and if Clinton didn't go, then it raises the possibility that there could be a problem between ASEAN and the U.S., because ASEAN satisfied that Myanmar has met the minimum requirements and includes it now as scheduled as a chair. She'll set conditions, but in other words, the real question is how far does Myanmar have to go before the rest of the world or the United States begins to see that it's a moment of opportunity? So I think the U.S. has. That's why she's going. Other countries are already shifting ground.
Ongoing violence against ethnic minorities remains a key issue for human rights groups. A report this week pointed to ongoing attacks against the ethnic Kachin people in northeastern Myanmar. The Kachin and the Kachin Independence Army, KIA, has been fighting the central government for greater autonomy over several decades. A ceasefire pact had been in place but broke down with the recent fighting. The report by the US-based Partners Relief and Development documented attacks on villages largely populated by women as recently as October. Ryan Erickson is co-author of the report and says the Myanmar army has been carrying out attacks that are potential war crimes against civilians.
These acts include torture, extrajudicial killing, the specific targeting of civilians, human shielding, unlawful arrest, unlawful detention, forced labor, forced relocation, displacement, property theft, and property destruction.
The report is one of several highlighting attacks on ethnic communities. Several sources, including Kachin, spoke of the Myanmar army's use of forms of chemical weapons or yellow rain against communities that triggered nausea and vomiting. Otni Gumar, a co-founder of the relief group, says they have also received reports of attacks on other communities.
Well, most of our reports right now are coming from Kachin State. As you all know, if you know about Burma, the same kind of things have been happening in Karen State and in Shan State. And as these things are happening in Kachin State, we're also getting similar reports from northern Shan State.
Gumar says the ongoing abuses are issues she wants to be seen taken up by the U.S. Secretary of State.
Yeah, definitely. I would want Hillary Clinton to bring this up as she's meeting with the leaders in Burma.
Those forced from their homes and now internally displaced faced increasing challenges.
Their main occupation right now is to try to stay alive and to try to find food and to try to stay warm and dry as they are living in the, you know, in the temporary camps.
Myanmar authorities have acknowledged attacks on ethnic minorities but claim the violence is not systematic. The Human Rights Report also coincides with reported talks between Kachin leaders and the Myanmar army in southern China this week, seen as a key move to return the region to peace and ongoing ceasefire talks. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
This week, Russians will be voting to determine the country's next parliament. But there is little enthusiasm ahead of the December 4th Duma elections. Some Russians say they won't bother to turn out because they feel that the outcome has already been determined, much like the presidential elections in 3 months, in which Vladimir Putin faces little opposition and is expected to win. Karen Percy reports from Moscow.
The 10,000-strong crowd at Sunday's United Russia Party Congress were eager to please the Prime Minister and presumed soon-to-be President Vladimir Putin. Delegate after delegate praised the man who has led this country in one way or another since 1999. In fact, the party revealed his candidacy at an event just like this one 2 months ago. Now it's official. The presidential vote is 3 months away, and no opposition candidate is expected to come anywhere near Putin. The more pressing concern for Putin and his party is this weekend's parliamentary elections, because United Russia has been losing support in recent months. Putin used the party congress to lean on voters.
I count on every serious, clever, progressive-thinking and responsible person who wishes the best for themselves and their country to support us during the Duma elections on December 4th, which will be led by Dmitry Medvedev. Дмитрий Анатольевич Медведев.
Along Moscow's traffic-choked streets, it's sometimes hard to tell that there's an election underway. There's the occasional billboard prompting Russians to vote. The posters bear a striking resemblance to the billboards being used by the United Russia Party, using the same colours, the same image. The only change is the ruling party's logo. It's a less than subtle reminder of just how stage-managed Russia's democracy is.
In one word, absent. I would say, you know, if you talked about democracy as institutions, it's completely absent here.
Russian-born Arkady Ostrovsky heads the Moscow bureau of The Economist news magazine. He will be watching to see how far the authorities go to rig the outcome of the vote.
You don't register parties, you don't want to come up, you don't allow those parties to unite into blocks, you don't allow single mandate candidates to run. So there are a lot of things they already have done.
Officially, there are 6 registered opposition parties in Russia. But in reality, many of the smaller parties have been co-opted by the ruling party.
Здравствуйте, меня зовут Светлана, приемная Митрохина, партия Яблоко.
The Yabloko Party was founded in 1993 and espouses a pro-market and pro-Europe outlook. The party's deputy chairperson is Sergei Mitrokhin.
Of course, there is no democracy in Russia. It's a soft totalitarian regime, just an imitation of democracy to look good in the eyes of the West.
In the 2007 parliamentary elections, Yabloko received less than 2% of the vote and has had no deputies in the Duma or the parliament since then. The party is hopeful that this time it will garner 7% of the vote, which will give it official status within the parliament. A lot will depend on whether voters bother to attend the polling stations. Again, Sergei Mitrokhin.
It's very indicative of any authoritarian state where the citizens are in political apathy. When citizens are active and demand changes, it's a very unpleasant situation for the ruling elite.
Russia's parliament is dominated by the United Russia Party, dubbed the party of crooks and thieves by opponents. The institution has little credibility in the eyes of ordinary Russians, who see the 450 Duma deputies as largely looking out for their own financial interests and who act as a rubber stamp for their benefactor, Vladimir Putin. Again, the Yabloko party's Sergei Mitrokhin.
It's very dangerous for the country because the ruling elite is not interested in real changes and reforms. The country is immersing into stagnation and crisis.
Since Vladimir Putin took over from Boris Yeltsin in 1999, democracy has slowly been eroding in Russia. Prime Minister Putin now appoints city mayors and provincial governors rather than allowing the people to elect local leaders. His government controls the broadcast media, the courts, the police, and the electoral commission, and corruption has increased manyfold. The economist Arkady Ostrovsky.
Not a single institution really works in Russia apart from corruption, because corruption has now become the glue. Corruption has become the system itself, not an illness, not a corrosion that can be taken away, but the actual system itself.
That system is taking a toll on citizens who worry constantly about rising health and education costs, a lack of jobs, and Russia's diminished role on the world stage. Arkady Ostrovsky says the government relies too heavily on revenues from resources like oil and gas, which it uses to bolster welfare and pension payments.
Russia has become less competitive rather than more competitive. And the money is used to, bribe the electorate.
Putin is expected to secure his position for another 12 years following next year's presidential election. In response to criticisms of stagnation and cronyism, he's hinted at vague changes to the political system.
We must have slow evolution to ensure stability. We must take a lot of care and responsibility to develop the system for the future generation.
But many don't expect he will act on his word. Karen Percy, Free Speech Radio News, Moscow, Russia.
How many reporters do you think it takes to make up a solid news organization? 10, 20, 50?
Matthew Petrillo, FSRN.
Noel King.
George Lander.
Madonna Virola.
Naomi Fowler, FSRN.
How about 250? That's the number at Free Speech Radio News. And because we're on six continents and in virtually every state, FSRN brings you the broadest perspective possible. FSRN airs thousands of community voices. We prioritize people affected by corporate and government policy over the people making those policies. We bring clarity to the chaos. You can help this effort. Visit fsrn.org to find out how. Activists in Central Florida say they will go to court to challenge new district boundaries. Orange County commissioners had been urged to create one district with a Hispanic majority to reflect a growing population. But Mayor Teresa Jacobs said that would take too many Hispanic voters out of a neighboring district. Members of the Black, Latino, and Puerto Rican Alliance for Justice say the plan approved Tuesday unfairly dilutes the Hispanic vote. Matthew Petty reports from Orlando, Florida.
In Orange County, the Hispanic population has nearly doubled in size over the last decade, from 168,000 to more than 300,000. Redrawing the district boundaries to reflect the change in population hasn't been easy. County commissioners and the mayor voted on a final plan at a meeting Tuesday, but many in the audience were unhappy with the outcome, like Puerto Rican activist Zenaida Rios Andino.
We want our district. We voted on our district. We have earned this district.
District 3 currently has a Hispanic population of 44.5%. Under the proposal adopted by the commissioners, that would drop to 41.5%. Activists wanted to boost the Hispanic population in District 3 to just over 52%, but the mayor, Teresa Jacobs, says that could have put the county on shaky legal grounds.
I think it would have exposed us to a claim of packing. And that's where politicians try to take minorities that maybe they don't want to hear from, put them all together in one district and say, okay, you got your one vote, but we can ignore you. And I know that that was not the intent of the citizens who presented that map, but it still concerns me from a legal standpoint that it could have that effect.
In District 6, the black population is slated to shrink from 59 to just under 56%. That still constitutes a majority, but David Rucker of the Black, Latino and Puerto Rican Alliance for Justice says it's not good enough. He says he would also go to court to fight for the rights of Hispanic voters.
Everybody needs to have justification to have good representation. We don't have it now. All right, even my commissioner, she didn't say anything. She reduced us down still. All right, at least we fought for her position. Now she's deluding. And then they still don't give the Latinos their representation. It's not fair. Things need to change, so I guess we ought to take them to court.
The Black, Latino and Puerto Rican Alliance for Justice hasn't said when it will file a lawsuit. However, Mayor Jacobs says despite what opponents think, she's confident the redistricting decision was the right one. Matthew Petty, FSRN, Orlando.
Earlier this month, FSRN's Alice Olstein reported on major banks making profits off the nation's jobless by charging fees on the prepaid debit cards that many states use to distribute unemployment benefits. Oregon, one of the states that charged the most fees, announced that it's renegotiating its contract with U.S. Bank to give unemployed Oregonians a better deal. For more on this development, we're joined by Alice Olstein. Hi, Alice.
Hello.
What's the latest on this deal in Oregon?
So the exact details of the contract won't be published until the end of the year, December 31st, but the state treasurer has announced that all point-of-sale, bank teller, and U.S. Bank ATM transactions will be free and unlimited, which they were not before. There was a cap on how many times a card user could go even to a U.S. bank ATM. So they've done away with that. But groups such as Economic Fairness Oregon still have criticisms of the new contract. The overdraft fee is still in place, it seems. Also, they are still charging a fee on using a non-U.S. bank ATM. That's an issue because a lot of Oregon communities are very rural and may not be near a U.S. bank, maybe in fact very far away from one. And it's also those rural communities where unemployment is especially prevalent.
And what could that mean for other states who have similar deals with private banks?
Well, nearly a dozen states are supposed to renegotiate their contracts before the end of next year, 2012. And now that these reports are out comparing each state's contract, there's a lot more transparency and a lot more tools for advocates to get involved. For instance, they can say, well, I'm looking at this report, and South Carolina also has a contract with U.S. Bank, and they don't have any penalty fees at all, no overdraft, no nothing. So it's unfair if our state does. Also, the federal government may have more of an involvement in the future. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois is spearheading a group of lawmakers that are pushing for more regulation of these contracts and sort of more assistance from the federal government when the states are going into these negotiations with the private banks.
That's FSRN's Alice Olstein giving us an update on bank fees and unemployment benefits. Thanks, Alice.
Thanks so much.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Special thanks to Moscow-based reporter Karen Percy. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.